Have you seen me dice bag?
The Grognard Files.
Hello, my name is Dirt the Dice, and this is the Grognard Files podcast, talking bobbins about tabletop RPGs from back in the day and today. I'm coming live from my den under the stairs in Adlington, Chorley, in the northwest of England. I'm surrounded by my stuff. My shelves are currently arranged like the Mirabilis Foundation, a private library in the heart of Manhattan, New York City, the central hub for our characters in Masks of Nyarlathotep campaign. The Foundation provided a stable of characters and continuity as the players went through the grinder. Here on my left is my ridiculous homemade shrine to the actor Caroline Munro. I'll just give it a tap. Ah yes, for this episode, the Eternal Champion has appeared as Carla from Brian Clemens' classic Hammer film, Captain Kronos, Vampire Hunter. For this episode, I'm reaching for the Call of Cthulhu Grognard file, down from the great library of RPGs, and revisiting this seminal game. And we've also had another review on iTunes from That There America. They're always very gratefully received and they give us a sanity boost. This one is from Guardianista. An excellent podcast focusing on the RPGs of the 1980s with a dash of discussion and how it relates to the games of today. Quite sophisticated analysis of these classic games wrapped in the warm, dulcet northern tones of Dirk and Blythe. Do yourself a favour and get listening. Thanks for the review. Sophisticated my arse. It was about 2 years ago, this month, that we published episode 2 of the Grog Pod, which was all about our experiences of playing Call of Cthulhu back in the day. It had such a significant impact on the way we played and how we thought about RPGs in general, that it was the game that brought us back playing together in 2010. A lot has changed for the game over the 2 years since that episode. The long-trailed publication of the 7th edition rules was fulfilled for its patient backers, and Chaosium developed a new lease of life under new management, and the Cthulhu line has become bolder, better illustrated and best-selling. In addition to the new rules and the accompanying scenario packs and supplements, there's been a substantial addition of the Pulp Cthulhu variant of the rules. In our own game, we've been playing the old-school classic Fungi from Yuggoth, the world-spanning campaign against the Brotherhood that we first played in 1987. We began playing it in September 2015 and we finished in July 2017. In this episode, we're going to review and reflect on these developments of the game since the last episode. To help us do this, we're very pleased to have Mike Mason, the line editor of Call of Cthulhu for Chaosium, who was responsible for seeing through the completion of the 7th edition project and the development of the line. He'll be opening the box and sharing some of his memories of his formative years in gaming to understand how he developed his interest in horror gaming and Call of Cthulhu in particular. In the next part, he'll be looking in detail at some of the most memorable games and campaigns that he's played in. Also in this part, part one, I will be heading to the bottom of the garden to see Ed in his shed, who was the keeper for the Fungi from Yuggoth campaign. We'll look at his scrapbook of handouts and understand his perspective on playing the game. After that, Blythe and I will disrupt our usual Gamesmaster screen format by doing it in the pub. So, sorry about the ambient noise in that section. It make you feel like you're actually there. So during the campaign, I noticed a point of difference between me and Blythe. It's always been there, to be honest, but I've not noticed it before. In this podcast, you'll have heard Blythe say, "I just want to be Indiana Jones," or "I just want to be James Bond." For him, it's about escapism. But more than that, he's driven by a desire to heroically put the world right. Whereas I'm happy to shrivel up in a corner and bang my head against a wall in angst and an existential crisis in the face of the awesome terror of the cosmos and our insignificance in the face of the abominable plans of the great old ones. It's been a long relationship. We want different things. But I guess part of the enduring appeal of Call of Cthulhu is that it poses the question, what is it that you actually want from playing these games? At the end, I'll tell you more about part two of the episode and how we'll be looking more closely at the 7th edition. Until then, ramblers, let's get rambling.
Open Box with Mike Mason.
Welcome to Open Box, the section of the podcast where we go back to the past to understand where we are now. This time we're joined by Mike Mason, the line editor for Call of Cthulhu at Chaosium, one of the writers of the new 7th edition and the author of Pulp Cthulhu, the two-fisted action-adventure variant of the rules. Now it's time to find out the gamer beneath the fez. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Hello. How are you doing?
May I offer congratulations on the Ennies, where Chaosium and Call of Cthulhu in particular did extremely well.
Oh, well, thanks very much. It was a splendid evening, although I wasn't there myself, but my Chaosium colleagues were there in force, and it was fantastic. It's great to see, you know, the books you've been spending the last, couple of years or more working on, getting recognised by the players, because obviously the Ennies is voted for by players of the games around the world. So it's a wonderful to kind of get that kind of recognition, and amazing really.
It must be particularly rewarding to you personally to see the results of this long-term project. And it shows your tenacity to see the 7th edition of Pulp Cthulhu published.
Well, I mean, Pulp Cthulhu started, probably 10 years before I even joined Chaosium. And it was one of those projects that back in the day had been announced that, oh, yeah, we're going to do Pulp Cthulhu, and everyone got very excited. And then it kind of just sort of melted away and died, and no one ever heard of it again. And occasionally you see on a forum somebody posting a comment about, whatever happened to Pulp Cthulhu? When's that coming out? And so when I was when I kind of got involved with Chaosium towards the tail end of the 7th edition kind of Kickstarter had kind of completed, and I joined the company then, one of the discussions and one of the stretch goals in the Kickstarter had been to release Pulp Cthulhu. So I joined the company, and apart from all the other things I was now doing, I kind of said, okay, so send me all the pulp files and I'll get that edited, and we can get that one ready then. Everyone kind of looked at me a bit blank and said, oh, okay, we'll dig out what we've got. and I think a couple of Word files appeared on my email, and it wasn't even, maybe there was one full chapter, but the rest were not really there. So I managed to track down James Lowder, friend of Chaosium, and now works for Chaosium as our fiction line editor. But he had been involved in the early days of Pulp Cthulhu, so he knew a little bit more than anyone else about what had actually happened. Using his wonderful network, managed to kind of track down various people that had been involved, the bits of writing they'd done, and I managed to kind of pull that together and kind of review that. Basically, it was a case of that some of the material was great, could be just needed a little bit of an edit and could be used, and then other pieces were, because it had been written, 10 plus years ago, were really out of date in terms of the mechanics or the nature and scope of what Pulp Cthulhu, in my mind, meant. So stuff by James Lowder, Jeff Tidball, Wolfgang Bauer was all, you know, it was all great, and could, you know, was able to kind of, you know, use that. And obviously that was great because it had a kind of a bit of a foundation. But unfortunately, a lot of the mechanical stuff and the rules, which unfortunately I'm not even sure I got the final version, whatever had been written 10 years ago, because what I got was not really, you know, very pulpy in terms of rules. So I kind of had to ditch all of that, unfortunately, and start afresh, which in one sense was you know, pain, but equally it was also a boon, because obviously I had a blank kind of canvas to kind of just get into it and build from the seventh edition rules, the kind of pulp rules that I felt would, you know, work well within, you know, within the Call of Cthulhu game. So yeah, it was an interesting process, and but I was really pleased I was able to kind of use some of the original material in the book.
Well, let's try and understand the gamer behind the editor and where that tenacity comes from. We always open the box with this question: how did you start, and who did you play with?
Well, I it goes way back to I think I'm terrible with dates and memory, but I think it goes back to kind of maybe late 1979 or 1980, around that period. And I you know, my knowledge of gaming, which I love playing games, but my knowledge of gaming was Monopoly and Cluedo and a few card games. And anything beyond that was completely alien to me. So a good friend of mine had a birthday party. And he just said, "Oh yeah, I'm having a birthday party. It's not really a party, so just come round and we're going to play a game." And that's all I knew. So I turned up and there's like, you know, six guys sat around the dining room table with, you know, with odd shaped dice. And what took my interest straight away was these cool little miniatures. And they had these like little skeletons and wizards and stuff. And I, that looked fantastic. We sat around and basically, I didn't know it at the time. The name D&D, Dungeons & Dragons, wasn't even mentioned. It was just like, you know, you're this bloke with a sword. What do you want to do? Well, I hit the skeleton a lot, please. And we played, you know, played with these little floor plans and miniatures for, you know, for a few hours. And we were, you know, not, I mean, I think it was... my friend's name was Philip Moore, and his, I think it was his brother, older brother, who was running the game. And we played for, you know, played for a while and really, you know, really getting into it, really enjoying it. And then his brother's mate said, "Oh, I've got to go home for tea." And so he, but he owned all the miniatures. So he was, you know, collecting all the miniatures. We were going, "Oh, no, we want to carry on playing." So then there was this big kind of discussion, almost argument about, "Oh, you know, come on, you've got to leave the miniatures," you know. And eventually I think he was kind of persuaded to leave some of the miniatures behind, so we could carry on playing for a couple more hours. And that's really my first experience. But I mean, from that first few hours, I was completely hooked. I mean, I thought the miniatures looked fantastic. They just really kind of played to my imagination. And the fact you could just, you know, wander around dungeons hitting things was fantastic. So that then kind of like, you know, sat there for a while, and I kind of found out the name of the game. But where I lived, there was no gaming shops. It was a kind of like, well, they just exist somewhere else. You know, it was kind of beyond my comprehension of how you could get hold of these things. And by happy coincidence, my history teacher at the time, Mr. Simmons, he was a big gamer. And in lessons, he'd like, you know, get us playing kind of these kind of war games, you know, Greeks fighting whoever and Romans and whatnot. And then one day during his class, he said, "Oh, anyone likes these games? Come back to my, you know, come back after school. I've got some stuff to show you." And so a few of us kind of went back, and he got out all these miniatures. Basically, the weekend before, he'd been to probably been to Nottingham, to be honest, to Games Workshop or somewhere, and picked up a load of miniatures and got them all out on the desk. And we were, you know, I remember there was like a fire giant, the old Citadel fire giant, an ogre and stuff like that. We were just all enthralled. And he said, "Right, well, I've got these. These are all spares. So I'm selling these." And basically he then started this trade in selling miniatures. And that quickly kind of rolled into him starting a gaming club on a Thursday night. And that's really how I guess I got to kind of learn about, you know, different kind of role-playing things and where you could get them from. And so that then led to me kind of badgering my dad to drive me to Leicester to a shop called Rider Design, which at the time sold lots of, you know, role-playing stuff, and also had this little cabinet of strange kind of jewellery, which, of course, over the years, the jewellery took off for them. They started selling more jewellery and stopped selling role-playing games. but yeah, so that's really my starting point. I just hooked through friends, I guess, and a gaming teacher.
So how soon did you start games mastering?
Pretty soon, because I think inevitably there was Mr. Simmons. He'd GM occasionally, but of course, as more people came to the club, there was far too many players. And I remember there was a couple of other guys, I think in the year above me, who would, you know, run things. And then it kind of just came down to, well, I had the stuff, and it's kind of like, well, I think I could do this. And so I started, you know, running things. I think, you know, running, is it B2, the Palace of the Silver Princess?
Oh, I don't know. Keep on the Borderlands?
I think that was the first thing I ran, and I think I ran that to death. I think that was the only scenario I actually owned. So any time I played, I was running that, basically, or I was playing myself. So I got pretty quickly into kind of running D&D. And that's all. Also, it also got me into trouble because I left that school and went... Oh, no, it was at that school, actually. And it was like a year later, and I was quite committed then to kind of gaming. I don't know, this is where the passion comes from. But I actually designed some posters to advertise the role playing club, and one of them got me into hot water because I had a call to go and visit the deputy head teacher, and they produced one of my posters saying had I designed this and you know, did you realise that it was scaring people? And I kind of looked a bit incredulously at it, because basically it was a really badly drawn Dalek saying, come to the role-playing club or you will be exterminated. So I managed to kind of get out of that one, more or less, by my luck and charm. And I left the promotion to everyone else from that point. But
a career in marketing beckoned.
Indeed, yes, it's exactly right. Yeah.
One of the themes we've had on the podcast is about the desire and difficulties of trying to find people to play with, and how tricky it was in those early days. It sounds like you never really had that problem. You've always managed to find people to play with.
Yeah, it's weird. When I started off, it was very much a, you know, it was very much a club thing, and so it was at that kind of really early days of role playing that it was really, you know, starting to kind of creep out into some, you know, like sci-fi modeling magazines and things like that. And so there was a kind of a bit of a buzz about it. You know, it was this unknown quantity, and there's a, you know, and so it captured the imagination of a lot of, you know, certainly a lot of boys at the school, And so there always seemed to be, you know, a group of people. And obviously there were a few that I tended to play more regularly with. And in fact, you know, we did kind of, whilst the club was going on, we had a splinter group that kind of met around a friend's house. I used to play in the school rugby team. And a couple of the guys in that also did role playing. And so we'd end up having to get up early on a Saturday morning, greasing ourselves with Vaseline against the cold on some awful rugby pitch in the middle of nowhere, playing some team. And then we'd all meet back around my mate's house in the afternoon, where his older brother would run us through a game. And so that kind of, you know, went on for a little while as well. So I always kind of had people. I mean, it's when my family moved, and we moved to a new place. And I was quite worried, thinking, oh, I don't know anyone, and let alone not knowing anyone, I'm not going to, you know, what am I going to do gaming-wise? Because I was well into it, as you can imagine. And I don't know, fates were just really kind to me, because the first day I went to the new school, I was kind of paired up with this, you know, this other guy in the tutor group. And so, maybe it was me. I just kind of mentioned, oh, has anyone played D&D here? And he said, yeah, I do. And so it was like, you know, I instantly found a new group, as it were. So I think I was just very lucky.
I'll just make a note of that. Mike Mason smears himself with Vaseline before role-playing.
I think I might have had a shower between the two, but I can't say with certainty.
So tell us about your first encounter with Call of Cthulhu.
Yeah, I'd moved school, and I kind of, there was a guy at school called Winnie, Dave Winfield, who I knew a little bit. I didn't really have any lessons with him, but he's one of those guys who kind of knew everyone. He's a really friendly guy. And he, you know, he games. So, we kind of, I think we must have obviously, you know, gamed a few times at school or whatever. And then one day in the playground, he kind of gets out. He's like, oh, you've seen these. And he got out these, you know, this, I think it was the Asylum and Other Tales and something else, Call of Cthulhu wise. And, I was like, oh, that looks great. Cause the artwork was, Tom Sullivan artwork on the cover. And I was, oh, that is amazing. Because, I mean, my experience of role-playing had been D&D and some RuneQuest at that time. And I knew about Traveller, but I hadn't really played it. So this kind of horror game was like, wow! You know, because I was, before I got into Call of Cthulhu, I've always been into horror and reading, you know, horror books and watching horror films. And so this kind of like, you know, just really kind of rang a bell. But again, because I lived nowhere near a gaming shop and had to rely on my dad, you know, when he had time and felt able to badger him to drive me to a role-playing shop and then getting him to spend some money for me. I had no way of really accessing stuff. So, but I think Imagine Magazine was out by then, and they did that Call of Cthulhu special. I remember it had a story by Brian Lumley in it, The Mirror of Nitocris. And that kind of gave you a real intro into, you know, what the game was and what it was all about. And so I read that kind of cover to cover at least three times, going like, oh, this is definitely what I want to get. And, I think Games Workshop had obviously just put out their reprint or production of the Call of Cthulhu box set, and so I managed to badger my dad to get that, and that kind of went from there really, and then I ended up being invited around Winnie's house to play Call of Cthulhu, and we never stopped really. And he's still one of my best friends today, and still play together, and it all kind of stemmed from his old school bag, to be honest.
So Call of Cthulhu game came first. Were you aware of H.P. Lovecraft before you began playing?
No, I don't think I was. I'd read plenty of kind of horror anthologies, you know, the old Herbert Van Thal horror collections and plenty of other things. So I think I must have read at least one Lovecraft story, at some point from the many, you know, anthologies I'd read. I mean, but I hadn't really, like many other authors in those anthologies, I hadn't really taken a note of who'd written them. I just kind of enjoyed the stories. So it wasn't really until the game came out that I kind of, oh, this Lovecraft chap. And of course, as soon as you start playing Call of Cthulhu, certainly back in the day, it was like, well, who is he? And you start, you know, me and Dave, in fact, would, you know, haunt every secondhand bookshop we could find, tracking down, you know, not only Lovecraft, but, you know, Robert E. Howard, Clark Ashton Smith, all these other kind of writers in the, what was the Lovecraft circle of the day, and tracking them down and buying as many secondhand books as we could, you know, and dreaming about these fabled things, you know, from Arkham House that, you know, you just wouldn't get in England unless you're very lucky. We had this side hobby suddenly start of book collecting, you know, collecting as much as we could. Fortunately, the Panther paperbacks of the Lovecraft collections were just kind of come out then as well. So we were actually able to walk into a shop and buy, you know, effectively collected Lovecraft stories, which, you know, maybe a year or two before we, you know, wouldn't have been there.
Yes, it was Grafton, wasn't it? He brought out a series of books around that time.
That's exactly
it. Distinctive covers.
Yes. So I remember completely devouring one of those while the London Marathon was on TV one Sunday, wet Sunday, I think.
These books are great, Mum. Ignore the monster eating a half-naked woman. There's nothing to worry about. Yeah, it seems to me that in that time, horror and transgressive stuff seemed to be more available. Even in the kids section of the bookshop, there was like the Beaver Book of Horror, Osborne Monster Books, and the horror films from the 30s and 40s were on in the early evening, much more than today.
Yeah, there is a definite kind of grim vibe to the 70s. Yeah, absolutely. I remember being really young and watching Leonard Nimoy's In Search Of series and that kind of stuff. But yeah, you'd walk into a bookshop and, you know, even, you know, they weren't children's books, but, you know, you would see all the James Herbert books, The Rats and The Dark, and then Sean Hudson's Slugs and all that kind of stuff, and Stephen King and whatnot. And they were, you know, they were big sellers in the day, and so they had a lot of shelf space. So it was hard not to avoid them, to be honest.
Our school, James Herbert books acted like a kind of contraband currency passing around the playground.
Oh, well, yeah, because, I mean, the rats would... Somebody would turn up with the rats going like, oh, have you got to read this? And it would just, like, go from person to person. And
always falling open at the same pages.
Yeah, definitely. And but, yeah, you don't... I can't say there's a real analogy to that in the modern day. I guess in the kind of mid-80s, it kind of turned to videos, where, you know, people would pass around, hey, here's a copy of The Evil Dead, have you seen this? And but nowadays, it's, well, who knows what people are accessing online? maybe it is all happening, but, you know, it's far more subverted than in our day, with a few paperbacks and the odd video. So,
well, as a parent nowadays, finding out that your child's been reading The Mucky Bits in Rats would be the least of your worries.
Exactly, yes, yeah. You're quite relieved, to be honest, yeah.
So does your love of horror explain how Call of Cthulhu came to predominate your role-playing?
I think it just naturally progressed into this kind of group that my friend Winnie had set up, because me and Dave didn't really GM that group. We had... another friend's, would become his brother-in-law. A chap called Gary Hall. He was going out with another Dave friend, his sister, and his sister and Gary would also play in the group. And Gary was an older chap, and he basically just would run stuff for us, and we'd just turn up and play. And then he'd turn up with like a really, you know, looking at it now, a really early copy of Dagon magazine. And I'd go, oh, what's that? And I'd, you know, copy down the address, you know, Carl Ford, etc., Twickenham. And it's 50p or whatever it is, and send a stamped address envelope. So, you know, the day after, I'd be sending 50p off to Carl Ford and getting into Dagon and then getting a subscription. So it kind of, you know, kind of steamrolled from there, really. And, you know, and Call of Cthulhu, you know, just became, I guess, my main game. But, I mean, I still played other things. I still played RuneQuest. I still played a bit of D&D. And you know, like any other gamer, you know, something new and shiny would come out. And I'd, get that. And... you know, maybe read it, maybe give it a play once or twice and then forget about it and, you know, go back to Cthulhu. So it just became the kind of default game. We all really loved it. We all just enjoyed that kind of investigation and horror. And I guess, you know, partly we were all a bit D&D played out. We'd all, you know, hacked enough dragons over the years preceding years that we wanted something a bit more. We wanted a bit more engagement and the kind of sense of getting involved in a kind of conspiracy mystery was just more enticing for us, I think. It just really held and captured our imagination. So it kind of, yeah, just kind of, you know, grew from there, really.
So you mentioned Dagon, fanzine that we talked about in episode 14. And you were a regular correspondent. You put H.P. Lovecraft himself to shame.
I haven't seen them in years, and I think I was very young. I'm just going to say I was very young, and I didn't know what the hell I was talking about mainly. But I was always surprised. I'd get the new copy come in the post, and finally get to the letters page. And like, oh bloody hell, they've put my letter in again. I mean, thinking back now, thinking like. Mr. Ford must have been pretty desperate because to fill space. I don't know, but to print my stuff. But Dagon was really central, I think, in that sense, because it really kind of, whilst, you know, we were enjoying the game and new stuff would come out, what Dagon added was a sense of community, that there was a wider, it wasn't just us playing this game, that there was a wider community of people that were really into this game as well. And so it became that kind of gateway into the community and also the gateway into the wider kind of literary world around the game. Because obviously of all role-playing games, whilst many of them are kind of informed or, you know, steeped in some kind of literary kind of background, you know, whether it's Tolkien or whoever, Call of Cthulhu 1 was really very proudly a kind of a literary game. It was like, you know, I think it even said at the time, you know, you want to play this game, we really recommend you go and read all these stories, which I don't think any other game really had said at the time. And so it really kind of said, you know, signposted you to go and read Lovecraft. And once you started reading Lovecraft and kind of understanding that, and then backed up by what was going on in Dagon, you were reading these other writers. And Dagon, what it did splendidly was introduce you to modern contemporary writers that you were kind of like, I'm aware of those, but I'd never read them. So, you know, people like Carl Edward Wagner and Thomas Ligotti and all these people that wouldn't necessarily, you know about, suddenly really widened your horizons. And obviously that all then became this kind of feedback loop that you're reading all these really kind of off the wall and really cool ideas and great horror stories by these new writers. And then feeding them all their ideas and snicking their ideas basically to put in your games as you know. And it became this wonderful, as I say, kind of feedback loop on itself. So there you go.
Well, thanks to @DailyDwarf. I have some of the letters that you wrote to the zine.
Oh no.
Well, many of your letters were about the authors that appeared in Dagon. But this one I like in particular a lot because it gives a hint of who you would become. So I'm going to read it. So, with regard to the review of Call of Cthulhu 3rd Edition rulebook, it seems that Chaosium and Games Workshop have spent about 5 minutes putting it together. The only thing that makes the book worth having is the excellent colour print and some of the monster pictures. Although some of them are a bit dodgy.
Oh, fantastic. How true. I think I still stand by that. I think we're talking about the Games Workshop hardback Call of Cthulhu edition, which I believe, which I know some people really hold up as their favourite edition, which I, you know. Well,
many people who listen to this podcast love that edition.
Yeah, I think it is a good addition, but I mean, if you look at it, you know, plainly, it is just the two Chaosium books put in side by side into a hardback. And my point was, it would have been better to kind of restructure them together; they would fit better rather than being effectively two separate books in one in a hardback, because both of those little books. You had the main rule book with some of the occupations in, but the other supplementary book that you got in the original box also had some professions in. So my point of view was, well, why don't you just put all the professions together in one place, not in two completely separate places in the book? I just didn't, it didn't make any logical sense to me. And that was really my point. But I still stand by the colour plates being very excellent.
Well, clearly it shows that you had the essential skills for Gaines Publishing. Has it always been your career?
No. It's funny when we were talking about the Dalek poster and you said marketing, because actually that's what I went on to do. I actually went into kind of promotions and marketing. I went to university and did a drama degree, which is neither here nor there. But I left university, and obviously with a drama degree, I had people falling over themselves to give me a job. So I kind of, I guess because I could reasonably communicate okay, I got a job in this marketing kind of department. And I worked in marketing for like 20 plus years. So I think it's there that I kind of really developed my kind of writing and editing skills, because I was writing, you know, press copy and marketing copy. And then, you know, when I kind of moved into kind of managing marketing teams, I was editing other people's copy. And so it was around about that time that Dagon had long since died. The Unspeakable Oath had been out, but then had kind of died too. And there was this real kind of vacuum in the kind of Call of Cthulhu community. And I was waiting for someone to fill it, and nobody did. So I was like, oh, well, sorry, I'll put out a little fanzine. And so I put together The Whisperer, which was, you know, just my attempt to kind of fill that vacuum and just have something out there that was, you know, about Call of Cthulhu and, you know, Lovecraftiana in general. And that was really, I guess, my first forays into actually producing game material in some sense. I did about an issue a year for about 5 years, and understood how much time it actually took to do. And finally, I just couldn't kind of sustain the amount of time it took against the day job and also having a young family. But it kind of opened the doors for me, I guess, in a way, because it gave me that kind of direct experience in terms of game texts and whatnot. And that led me to doing a bit of freelance work, editing for Curtium. Also, you know, I'd written a few scenarios, and I think one ended up in Valkyrie magazine. And it was also in tandem with doing The Whisperer, I'd also started The Cult of Keepers in the UK, which was basically a bunch of Call of Cthulhu keepers who would get together at different conventions and basically just run Call of Cthulhu. And we kind of would do that and maybe kind of have this kind of loose tournament to kind of give it a bit of a shape. So I started to meet a lot of other, you know, Call of Cthulhu players and, you know, met some keepers who would then go on to become, you know, writers alongside myself, people like Paul Fricker, Scott Dorwood, for instance. So that was that, you know, from those kind of beginnings of, you know, actively writing scenarios for conventions, running them at conventions, meeting other people, producing this fanzine, kind of really kind of congealed all this kind of Lovecraftiana together for me. But it was always a kind of a hobby. It was always a hobby. Although I did a bit of freelance, it was only, you know, once in a blue moon. But what it also opened the door to was I would be going to conventions where I would be meeting the people who actually worked at Curtium. So people, probably more, you know, Charlie Crank, who would come over to certain conventions in the UK or Germany, which I'd go to. So I kind of got to know him and some of the other people at Curtium. And so that kind of allowed me and Paul to one day turn around to him and say, like, you know, do you have plans to do a new edition? It's been, you know, over 10 years since the last one. We think it's a little creaky. we think we could make a few improvements, and is that something you'd be interested in? And he said, yes, definitely. I really want to do a new edition. I'd be, more than happy for you guys to take a stab at it. And we said, okay, well, we'll go away and we'll see what we can do. And so we went away for 4 years and developed what would become 7th edition, and then sort of turned up back with it, and it kind of, and then went from there, really. Charlie was happy with it, and we said, well, we're not entirely sure. There's a few quite radical things in here we're not really sure about. We want to play test it extensively. And so we, it was me and Paul who actually operated the big playtest, public playtest we did for 7th edition, and had people from all around the world, getting hold of the playtest set and sending in copious amounts of feedback, which helped to inform us on how, what was good, what we shouldn't do, and what was kind of like borderline. There were certain rules that we knew some people loved and some people hated, things like spending luck in the game. And when we kind of did our kind of survey of responses on those kind of questions, it just came back 50-50. And so it's kind of like, well, let's make that an optional rule then. Let's just put it in the book as an optional rule, because clearly some people really like the rule and want to use it. Other people don't like it. So, so that the whole playtesting really kind of really helped to kind of cement how the book would become. It's a kind of a fairly direct road, I guess, in one sense, from playing Call of Cthulhu into kind of, becoming line editor in terms of my story. But it was a fairly convoluted route to get there. And it wasn't ever my intention, if you see what I mean. It was a hobby, like everyone else, it's a hobby. And I started to just write a bit, but I'd never kind of, I always knew from, listening to other, writers that, it's very hard to make a, career out of writing for role-playing games, certainly very hard to make a meaningful income. So I'd never even countenanced the idea that that would be a possibility, and just relied on the day job. And this is what I did, when I had a bit of spare time. When Curzium actually turned around and said, well, we need a line editor and, we'd like you to consider it. The back of my mind was like, fantastic. Yeah. Yes is the answer. But equally it was like, well, can I afford to do this? I don't know if I can, I don't know if you're even going to pay me, if it's just a kind of a nominal thing. Happily, it kind of worked out that I could afford to kind of pack in the day job and actually go full time as working for Curzium, which is I guess a dream come true to some degree.
Well, the next part of this episode, we're going to look at the 7th edition in more detail. As you know, our constituency of listeners is mainly old time gamers who don't like change very much, or people who have come back into the hobby after hiatus. Why should they get the new edition rather than sticking with the familiar editions with its dodgy monsters?
Well, I mean, there's nothing to stop them doing that. I mean, if that's what's warm and cuddly and familiar, then fine, great. At the end of the day, if they're playing Call of Cthulhu, I'm happy. But I think picking up the new book, in one sense, it's a genuine evolution and refinement of the Call of Cthulhu system. It's still the same system. It's still the same rules. However, there are some refinements and tweaks that kind of, I have to say, I feel that they improve the gameplay. They streamline certain things. They correct certain ambiguities that existed in the rules, such as grappling. Ask any group of, 6th edition and before Call of Cthulhu Keepers to tell me what the grappling rule is and how it works. I don't think I get the same answer from any of them. and certainly there used to be forums filled with, like, you know, how does grappling work? And nobody could give a straight answer. They all had an opinion, but clearly the rule was unclear. So, you know, to refine, you know, rules like that in the new edition hopefully helps the game, because you don't have this ambiguity and you don't have to kind of like make up a rule on the spot necessarily to, you know, hope that it's going to work. So it is a refinement of the rules. It's also the first edition in full colour with, you know, lots of, you know, full colour gorgeous art throughout of it. So as an artifact, it's a wonderfully beautiful thing. And of course, the other thing is, if you're getting back into the game, why wouldn't you pick up the latest edition? You know, if you were getting into D&D now, having played it back in 1984, I think it's natural you would go and pick up the new edition, because you'd want to see where the game had, you know, what the game was now, where it had gone to. And I think that's no different to, you know, Call of Cthulhu and any other system. You know, you tend to, you know, go and get the latest thing and then, you know, use that as you will. The other thing with 7th edition is that, you know, we kind of wrote it as a toolkit. We wrote it because the game is, you know, 35 plus years old. And we know, because we do it ourselves, that people play the game in different ways. And people always have created house rules over the years to fill in gaps and all that kind of thing. And Call of Cthulhu still remains no different. And that's why throughout all of the rules chapters in the book, at the end of every one of those chapters is a series of optional rules that allows you to further tweak the game to the style that you and your group prefer. So I think that kind of 35 years of informed gameplay and experience is what is kind of culminated into the latest edition of the game. So I think, you know, well, why wouldn't you want all of that? Because it's not just our experience and our opinions in that book. It is informed by hundreds of people around the world playtesting it and other writers we know who inputted into the process in terms of, you know, shaping our ideas and experiences. So I think, well, why wouldn't you want to pick it up, to be honest? It's the fairest answer I can give, I think.
What always strikes me about you, Mike, when I listen to you in interviews or on panels, you're very passionate about the game and particularly about its adaptability and ability to accommodate many different styles of horror gaming.
I think that's absolutely true. I think why Call of Cthulhu is still around and why it is, you know, the most popular kind of game of its style is because it is, in one sense, it is tailored to, you know, the nature of investigation and horror gaming. With a kind of a Lovecraftian kind of sensibility, but it is generic enough that you can play it in whatever style or means you want to play. If you don't like the kind of Lovecraftian Cthulhu mythos, you can just play it as a straight kind of Hammer horror game. You can play it, you know, very grim, dark, and gritty, and slow moving investigation. You can play it as a horror film where it's very action orientated, or very, you know, immediate with hardly any investigation. It becomes a survival horror game. And I think it can be all these things and all points in between. And I think the system is flexible and easy. And also, I think the system is really intuitive. The whole percentile-based system is when you have a bunch of people around the table who have never role-played before, you can show them Call of Cthulhu and you can say, well, you've got 70% in shooting this handgun. And they immediately understand what that means, because they understand that 70% is pretty good. So I'm pretty good at shooting handgun. Yes, you are. Whereas you've only got 5% in reading French. And it's like, well, okay, and I understand that. You haven't got to explain what, you know, I've got French at 16. Well, what's 16 mean? Whereas percentage is very intuitive. So I always find Call of Cthulhu is a great game for introducing new people into gaming, to be honest, because it just fits, because they haven't got to imagine a fantasy land and try and comprehend what that means, or, you know, what is a barbarian in Tolkien mean, or a hobbit. They can understand what a librarian is, or a detective is, or a doctor is. They immediately understand the character. So you're suddenly getting over these hurdles that you may have with other games. So I find it, as I always call it, I think it is a gateway game. I think people do enter, you know, the gaming community through games like Call of Cthulhu. It's not the only one, obviously, but I think it is a very accessible game in that way.
I agree. The new rules do feel more inclusive as well as intuitive. Well, Mike, until next time when you face the Keeper's screen, thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Dirk. It's been a pleasure.
It's brand new shed. Ooh, fancy.
Okay, I've not been down here for a while, going down this path to the bottom of the garden. Oh, what's this? A new metal eldritch shed. He's gone up in the world. I'll just give it a knock.
Come in.
Hello there, Ed.
Hello there, Dirk.
What's that in the jar there? Is that your brain?
That's my brain, yeah. Talking you through a mouthpiece with wires attached to it.
Right. Looks like a gherkin. Right. So, you got a gherkin in a jar. You're in a metal shed. It can only mean one thing. We've come to talk about fungi from your gut. Okay.
Fungi.
Don't start with that. Fungi. Fungi's not even Lovecraftian. We've not even started yet, have we? Me go, my go. So let's just remind listeners the history of this supplement, so where it came from, and the background to it, because we talked about it, didn't we, way back when we did the original episode.
Yeah, well, the Fungi from Yuggoth came out in 1984, and I think I must have bought it around 85, I think 86. It was after I'd got Master Nihilus attack, because I bought that first. And it was a cracking massive campaign, but it was almost too big to comprehend, so I went back and picked up Fungi from Yuggoth, which seemed more manageable. Now, that was the first one in 84, and there was, I think, another one in 1990, was it? There's Curse of Cthulhu, released in 1990. According to the inside of The Day of the Beast, which is the third iteration of the Fungi from Yuggoth, just with a different name. Again, the Curse of Cthulhu is exactly the same as Fungi from Yuggoth, the exact same print and everything, typeface and font and pictures. I think it's just got a few extra scenarios in it that have nothing to do with the actual Fungi from Yuggoth.
And we actually played it, didn't we, back in the day, Fungi from Yuggoth. What do you remember of playing it back then?
Well, as you know, my mind's been wiped, and I have very few memories of it. There's a couple of bits when I was reading through it again that started to come through, namely the kind of second scenario. It was the thing in the well, which was that one where you were in Boston, that old house, and there was a...
That's a really good scenario.
It's like a creepy, it's kind of a creepy in a way. There's an old woman in the house, and there's this son. I don't want to spoil it. Can I spoil it?
We can get...
The clue's in the title, which is why I didn't say we're going to run the thing in the well before we actually we play it.
Because otherwise we just said, right, let's have a look what's in the well.
So, yeah, and then they released it as Day of the Beast, and they tacked on even three or four more scenarios, which is supposed to have made it into one larger campaign, but the extra scenarios are not really to do with it, just kind of touch on it at the beginning.
The bit I remember when we played it back in the day was the Peru section, and I remember the mine, and I'm surprised, though, when we played it, not much else came back.
And you played it the second time?
Yeah, playing it the second time. Not much play.
I think...
Maybe we've all been white man.
Yeah, well, that's it. I don't remember getting to Peru. I think when we talked about it a few years ago, I think I remember getting up to Peru, but not running it. I think I did... It was Egypt before the Peru, so we got to that, and then I thought we stopped there, but you may be right. You have better memory than me.
Yeah. So, running it this time, how have you found being the keeper?
I think the big difference is the time. I mean, I first read this 2 years ago on holiday three times.
Yeah.
And then we play it once a month. And
with breaks.
So once a month, two or three times. And then we have a break for three or four months, maybe 6 months.
Yeah.
So you have a lot of time to read it again and read it again and read it again and prepare, get stuff. So, you know, I have a lot more time to think. Whereas before in the day, we probably ran it all within a week.
Yeah, buy it on a Saturday.
I read it once and read the first chapter again and then underlined bits in pencil and we're running it Sunday afternoon.
So how does that make it different?
I just think it gives you time to read between the lines a bit. You can pick bits out. You can add stuff to it. I mean, it's quite a slim campaign, really. But it does lead itself to a lot of expansion if you want to.
Yes.
Which I prefer that than the opposite. I prefer that than bloated. And you try and think, oh, I'll cut that out or I'll take that away. Or it just asks to be expanded a little bit or swapped around or changed.
So what was the best bit for you as a keeper?
Running it now?
Yeah.
There was quite a few. I liked the thing in the well.
Yeah.
I think which was the second one. I think.
Yeah, that was really good because it felt like almost like a one shot, didn't it? It felt like an isolated story within the campaign.
You'd got the initial introduction, which was a little bit vague, and you'd rescued the guy from the hospital, which is quite a good scenario. But the other was like more of a creepy haunted house kind of thing. Oh, that's how I perceived it.
Yeah.
Whether it actually ran like that, but there was again an example of where you add stuff to. There was a bit where you explored the tomb at the beginning. There were some ghouls that opened the tomb. Now, that's not in Fungi for me. It mentions it.
Yeah.
But it's not there. So I made that up. I added a little bit and a few newspaper reports to take you to that.
Yes.
Because I knew it wasn't enough for an evening.
Yeah.
It's only about 2 hours worth, so I thought I'd need another hour here. So I thought I put a tomb exploration in it. And I think it worked. It expanded to it well. I think it... added to it from my point of view anyway.
Yeah. What were the biggest challenges? So what were the bits that, looking back on it, you didn't enjoy as much?
I always find the more open-ended ones with lots of characters. This is me personally, lots of characters, where you've got a kind of, there's not a lot of plot, but there's a lot of talky-talky, a lot of different people, a little bit of, and I always find that hard.
Yeah,
you kind of
but there's not an awful lot of that in here, is there?
No, it's a traditional old school.
Yeah,
you can see the I don't know the dungeon elements.
It is old school because it's more about adventure, isn't it, than investigation and mystery.
Yeah,
it kind of plays second fiddle to doesn't it?
It's very Indiana Jones if you want it to be like that, because it's like underground passageways and there's. Catacombs and there's caves up in the mountains and there's things like that, and you know there's thrilling locations like that could take you to that. And again, I find that is great. You know, like I said, the challenge for me was a bit where you have a lot of characters.
Yeah.
You could, like, the first scenario is a bit like that where you've got several people you can go. You know, there's a gangster, there's the doctor at the hospital, there's several other things that you can kind of just spend half an hour just chatting to them.
Yeah.
Some people like that, I personally.
But I enjoyed that. I enjoyed that first one because that was the one that really had the sense of mystery that needed to be resolved. What I think happened as the campaign went on, it was more about finding where we needed to get to next.
Yeah, it's a paper trail, really.
Yeah.
And there's only one place to go at the end of it. Whereas the difference with, I'd say, Mass and Eiffel attempt, we got to a location, the locations were bigger.
Yeah.
There's several avenues to go in these locations. In Fungi, there's only one place to go. Find the clue, you go to the next place.
Yeah.
It's just like a paper trail. You find your piece of evidence and then you're off to your next one.
So as part of that paper trail, what you introduced to this campaign for the first time was a scrapbook that we had to put in the player handouts, and you spent a lot of time on the handouts. So just talk us through what you did with that.
Well, it seems to be, but I think initially the idea was just to stick the handouts that you get them, because you end up just clipping them to your character sheet. They get lost and you lose it. So I think for any Call of Cthulhu scenario, just get a scrapbook or a bit of paper that someone can stick the handouts to, and they can read on the next session that they get to and follow it on from there. So,
but what amazing handouts, because for every NPC that we encountered, you had a photograph mugshot.
Well, yeah, I think...
Time on your hands, come back
to you. Too much time on your hands. Working in a repro graphics department, you can kind of do these things. Relatively legitimately.
Relatively.
So it's so easy to just type in 1930s actors 1930s portraits, and you just get tons of pictures of people, whether they're famous or not, or whether they're criminals, or whether you don't know who they are. They could be mass murderers.
Well, I think Ernest Hemingway turned up.
He did pop up, yeah, and I didn't notice that at first, but then I thought, I do know that face, but never mind, I'll use it. And there's a mate, whether I struck lucky, there was some that seemed just perfect for the, well, there he is, Ernest Hemingway. Like, I don't know who he is with the hat on, but he was Uncle Victor in Peru. But he just looked like an Uncle Victor, didn't he?
Yeah.
That's just a fluke. You know, Professor Galloway, that's just a fluke. I mean, him. You look at him there. And that's almost like him there, isn't it?
On the cover, yeah.
On the cover of the thing.
Yeah,
it is. Just, I don't know. Just look.
And as we said when we talked about it, that a lot of the mystery is in the handouts, isn't it? So that paper trail, it's in there, and the kind of conspiracy that's happening in the background is found in the letters. And the letters were great as well. So did you do those?
Well, some actually was from a site called Cthulhu Reborn, which have got the fungi from Yuggoth handouts as PDFs, which anybody can download. So I just picked up them, and some were brilliant ones. You know, some had been... you know, that one, the Baron Hartman letter with letterheads and everything. Because one of the downsides of the fungi from Yuggoth, all the handouts are very, very plain.
Yeah.
They're very, very just standard type on a page and in a square that you cut out and you hand them out, which is how it was back in the day. You wouldn't have thought of giving a letter or a folded up and actually looking like a proper letter back then. I mean, these have come on in the last 30 years, so there is stuff available for anybody to use. And some stuff I've added myself. I mean, what's that other thing? A bill, you know, the Woods Estate Rest Home, I typed that up, used something that I picked up online and invoice of services and just edited it, brushed bits out and put a new title on. So that's just a clue, because in some parts of the campaign, they don't really give you a clue to get to the next one. So I like to reinforce that.
One of the good things that he did as well is after, because as you said, there was a gap between us playing sometimes, he did like a news report to say what had happened last
time.
That's
right, yeah, I think some accident in a tomb or something, which was obviously made up by the press to kind of, or a cover story from one of the rich, I think it was one of your characters, a debutante, was it?
Yeah, yeah.
Who got, was she crushed in this thing, like a big crocodile monster?
Well, I think she got her head ripped off, by a shantak.
I thought, with the news report, this, I thought, they'll just have it as an accident or it'll be hushed up or something. And so I kind of made up that story. And there was an app I downloaded. Oh, what's it called now? I've forgotten what it's called. But it allows you to.
What if I asked the gherkin in the jail? Would that remember? No.
It is called Readable Deception. An editable newspaper available on
DriveThruRPG. We'll put it in the show notes anyway. Yeah,
it's a thing that gives you like a facsimile of a newspaper with articles around the side, and it gives you a blank box that you could type in that article. And you can write everything and make it, and it comes in the font that would have been available then. It was only a cheap app. It's something from DriveThruRPG, and it's brilliant. Yeah. So for $5 or whatever it was, I did the last few handouts, was using that to make it look like authentic newspaper clippings.
Yeah.
So
yeah, well, I'll put a link to that in the show notes, as I say. So when we started this campaign, you said this is a poor man's Masks of Nyarlathotep. Do you still think that?
I do, yeah. Because it was only something like £5 or something at the time. I think it was about 10-20 quid. But no, it's obviously got a lot of similarities. It even follows some of the locations, and it's like a watered down. Whereas you go to London in Masks of Nyarlathotep, there's like four sections. But there's not London in this. It's just the one scenario. You go to Transylvania, just the one scenario. You go to Egypt, it's just the one scenario. Whereas you go to Egypt, say in Masks of Nyarlathotep, you've got three or four little elements going on, isn't there?
Yeah.
You can go, it's like...
What it did share with Masks of Nyarlathotep is those big scenes, didn't it? So, like going to Salerno and, you know, like when we saw the ritual on the seashore and that, those kind of things. And I suppose that's the thing with this old school thing, and this is what I've realised over these past 2 years of playing it, is that it's very much a pulp adventure, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not... the horror
yeah.
is not, it's not, it's not a horror thing in, implicitly. It's not a horror mystery.
No.
It's more of a gung-ho like adventure.
It is designed like a Dungeons and Dragons adventure. And that's, yeah. that's maybe selling it a bit short. It's better than that. But it's as though you've got to combat everything at the end. But you don't have to do, as we know now. You can leave it. You can back off. Because the ultimate aim of this campaign is to get to the end. Yeah. To find, unravel the mystery, not kill the monsters that are there at the end. Like, you're always tempted to tackle them, but you don't have to do that. No. You can back off. But I'll leave that up to the players if they want to do that.
And towards the end, you converted it to 7th edition. So
yeah.
Was that easy?
Very easy, really. I mean, you don't really have to change much. For those who are running 7th edition now and want to pick it up and run it, you could do it basically straight off. You just have to multiply all the stats.
Yeah. As a player, it felt a lot different because that pulpy feel seemed to be increased. Because
did you find it more? But yeah, see, I weren't sure how it went.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I'm not a big, heavy rules reader. I kind of try and familiarise myself as best I can, but I don't try and stick to them. And I felt I didn't know what rules I were using at some time.
Yeah, yeah.
I can't remember whether this is the 5th or the 7th or whatever, which is what we did before. But there's a few areas that you can, like the beast at the end, the strength is 200. So you got to multiply everything by 5. So you've got this beast with a strength of 1,000 and you can't cast a spell, the barrier of Natchtith, to stop this bloody beast. And you think, what, let's talk about mega mathematics.
Yeah, yeah.
You got to kind of, what is it, 10d10 or something. We had to know it was more than that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, we ended up doing it on the 100d10
or something. Yeah. God knows whether that were right. Who knows?
It was good fun, though. So what would you like to do next when it comes to Call of Cthulhu? Because really, Call of Cthulhu is your game, isn't it? It's the game that you...
Well, I mean, it's something that I ran more then, back in the day, didn't I?
Yeah.
I don't like the thought that I'm hogging the game.
I'm not suggesting that.
there's so many stuff that I could do. I'd like to run... if you had to do one next and you held me to it now, I think I'd like to do a Pulp Cthulhu, but using an Actun Cthulhu campaign, which is the Shadows of Atlantis, which is set just before the Second World War. So it's got Nazis in. It's very, very Indiana Jones. It's a good campaign, but it suffers from bloat because it's got masses and masses of stuff that you could just pick up. Like, say this, where it was... doing a chapter on Peru, you'd flip through Wikipedia and you think, oh, okay, I know a little bit about Peru now, get some pan pipes on and you're away. whereas the Shadows of Atlantis, it gives you like 20 odd pages of Peruvian history from the dawn of time.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't need that these, it's too much.
It's only
interesting, but if you need to find stuff at the table,
you can find it, can't you?
You can in the fungi. You can find, it's laid out really well. Yeah. It's small, you can find.
It's only relevant if it's relevant at the table, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Anything else is just extra.
Yeah. Well, that's good. Well, it's good to come back. It's come good, and you've done a good job with this metal shed.
That's it. It's me, go resistant.
Well, I'll leave you with your gherkin and a sandwich.
That's the wife. Don't insult the wife.
See you later, Odin.
See you later.
Games Master Screen. On location.
Hello, Blady.
Hello, Dirk.
Well, we've left Dirk Towers and we're going to record this bit on location. We're at the Lasagowry in the greatest city in the world, Manchester.
Mm-hmm.
And we're on a Jolly Boys outing.
We are.
A JBO, as we call them. We're about to go and see Still Marillion, a tribute act to Marillion. Because back in the day, prog rock and role playing went together like
they went hand in hand. Rick Wakeman in a pointy hat,
fish
role playing game. Fish,
how many of our characters, how many of my characters were based on fish from Marillion?
There were
so many of them.
You rolled a character for Twilight 2000, didn't you? Based on a pacifist Scottish character, based on fish,
with a white feather.
We should stress perhaps that when we say we're going watching the Marillion tribute act, it's only Marillion as far as Clutching at Straws.
Yes, it does.
Beyond that, they're dead to us.
Yes,
they don't exist. Once fish left, that's it. We'd have nothing to do with them.
That's right.
I should have a refined band. we have nothing to do with them.
So if you're in the UK and you like Marillion, look out for Still Marillion because they're really good.
They are very good, yeah.
Yeah. Mm. Not only is it a great name for a tribute act, Still Marillion, what else would you come up with?
No, they come up with much. It's not a great tribute.
No.
No.
I'm looking forward to one day there being a Kaylee band.
Kaylee.
So, you know, like a... And I playing Fugazi on a fiddle. I think it could work.
Well, you can go and watch that one on your own.
Right. So, we're on a Jolly Boys outing, and we thought that we'd come to the comfort of La Sagari. We're 2 pints in, so we'll just warn you now.
Warn you now. It may be a bit even an improvement in quality.
Or a deterioration.
I suspect the latter.
And we're talking about fungi from Yuggoth. Yes. It's easy to say when you've had 2 pints.
Fungi from Yuggoth. Cthulhu after 2 pints. We can't pronounce it sober. Never mind after 2 pints.
So Fungi from Yuggoth, we've just finished that campaign, and so we're going to talk about it. So this is a Games Master screen. But I haven't brought a Games Master screen with me. I'm going to have to be exposed.
Yes.
In the middle.
In the pub. Yeah. Last time you did that, I got thrown out.
So we're going to go through this, and we've got on this side I've got a table which I'm going to roll some imaginary dice, because I don't have any dice with me.
That's all right.
So here we go. Let's go. And first of all, I want to talk about set pieces. So, Blythe, what was your favourite set piece from you, Matt?
Oh, well, there were several set pieces, weren't there? Egypt was good. The mummy's tomb in Egypt. Baron Hartman's castle.
Yeah,
I enjoyed that one.
So
Baron Hartman's castle was good.
Yeah,
kind of crept in there, didn't we? In true Cthulhu style, we found the haunted castle.
It's an interesting campaign, isn't it? Because it seems to be composed of a series of linked adventures, much more than say Masks of Nyarlathotep, because it's much more separate scenarios linked together with this common overarching theme.
Yeah,
and you were like going from one place to another.
Yeah,
it didn't feel quite as fluid as Masks of Nyarlathotep. We had to do things in a certain order, didn't we?
Yeah, and it's got more of a pulpy feel to it, hasn't it? As well, Masks of Nyarlathotep did to some extent, but Fungi from Yuggoth. I mean, it's again the mummy's tomb bit is very pulpy, isn't it?
When
you go in there, and you know, the mummy comes alive and attacks you. That's very kind of old school, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. It did have that feel to it, you know. Master Arthur Tap's a bit pulpy as well.
Yeah.
You know.
But I do think it is a series of set pieces that are strung together with this story. The one that I remember is the Solanos. Where you go to this library.
In space.
Yeah.
Yes, my character went there, didn't you? Yeah. Is it Isabel Dawson?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Quite difficult to pull off, though, aren't they, those things?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what struck me about that. It's a difficult thing to pull off, isn't it? Because you're going from 1920s America, 1920s Europe, to a library in outer space. And I remember she met a character, some kind of alien chap, riding a giant beetle or something, wasn't it?
Yeah.
That all went on. And it is a difficult thing to... good to pull off. I mean, I think Eddie was running it, and he did a good job. I mean, credit, he did a good job of it. But I remember when he was running it, thinking, I'm glad I'm not running this. I'm glad I'm just the player and not the games master, because it's quite a difficult thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah.
It conjures that sense of going from a real world setting, albeit a real world with the threat of tentacled monsters. But that said, still a real world. You know, we were in Baron Hartman's castle, weren't we?
Yeah.
We found some space mead. Which I've had 2 pints of that already. So a bit more. We found the space mead and we travelled into space.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's that leap, isn't it, in Cthulhu of the real world to nothing like the real world. You're travelling through space and you're going to some weird cosmic library and meet an alien who rides a giant beetle. Very difficult to put that across in a convincing way, I think.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, it's a difficult game to run, isn't it?
Yeah. I have to say, though, I mean, this is the first time that I played Call of Cthulhu alongside you since back in the day.
Yeah.
I think even back in the day, we didn't play it together that much.
Yeah.
We played in a few edits, because we played...
Well, it was either you running it for me and Eddie,
yeah,
or Eddie running it for me and you, but it was predominantly, you used to predominantly run it.
Yeah.
I've not really run much Cthulhu at all.
No, no. What I noticed playing it, I suppose this is the thing, isn't it, that we've been together for a long, long time, and during this campaign, I think I learned a lot about you as a player, more than I probably have done when we played alongside each other in RuneQuest. And I think there's a particular set piece where we were in Mexico, and we found this base, this underground lair of the Migo, the kind of these alien
Migo.
You say Migo, I say Migo.
Mexico, Amigo.
Amigo, yeah.
Amigo.
It is Amigo.
Amigo.
We saw Amigo. And we went into this lair, and for a moment our characters felt discombobulated, because at the same time we were looking at ourselves, we were looking at this kind of strange army of creatures crawling on top of each other, watching ourselves looking at that from the moon. And we felt like out of joint, things were out of joint. However, in that scene, as Eddie was describing it, all I could see in your eyes was, shall we use dynamite?
Yes, by default setting, Cthulhu. How much dynamite have we got? Have we got enough to blow it up?
But what I realised at that point was, for you, this was a scene that you wanted to fix.
Yes.
Put right.
Yes. Well, I think you're right, and I think this is always one of the things I've struggled with Cthulhu, all throughout the time we've played it, in that sometimes you don't quite know what to do. And maybe it's something to do with H.P. Lovecraft. You know, he's kind of writing, I'm not... it's okay, but I'm not a huge H.P. Lovecraft fan. Maybe it has something to do with that, in that, you know, if you're a huge H.P. Lovecraft fan and you find yourself in a Migo kind of colony, that's a big deal, you know, in the same way that, as a Moorcock fan, finding myself in the Young Kingdoms is a thrill for me. Maybe it's something to do with that. But I think it has more to do with that sense of, at times, you can't do anything about things. For me, a good role-playing game has that sense of agency, where as a player, you can fix stuff, you can do stuff. So there's something creating a threat or creating a problem, and as a role player, your character goes in and has a crack at fixing it. That's what they do. They may fail in that, but they do something about it.
But I think that's the difference. I think that's what I learned about us as players, because to do that within Cthulhu, Call of Cthulhu, is quite difficult.
Yes.
And even if we were playing it quite pulpy, weren't we? So that, you know, Eddie's always of the view. I mean, our final scene was us kind of punching the lights out of cultists and then on a zeppelin and blowing it up.
Yes, and that, it was. Eddie runs it like that, and that's good. I like that. That's a good thing.
But that scene, that particular scene, you see, I think... I felt that was a truly Lovecraftian scene.
Yeah, yeah.
It reminds me of the poem, the sonic sequence that it's based on, the fungi from Yuggoth. And there's a moment I saw a body. I'm pretending that I know this off the top of my head, but I'm actually reading it.
Yeah.
But we'll cut this bit out where I'm saying explain it. I saw bodies spread on that dark stone, and knew that those things that feasted were not men. I knew this strange grey world was not my own, but Yuggoth's past the starry voids. And when the body shrieked, within me gave a dead cry, and all too late, I knew that it was I. And it's that feeling that, simultaneously being
inside but outside your body, and feeling that there's this great big cosmic horror.
Yeah.
But you didn't feel that. You wanted to blow it all up.
I didn't want to blow it up. I just thought, how are we supposed to fix this?
Yeah, but I didn't. You know? What isn't the point of that scene to make you feel that we are?
Yes, insignificant. I see that, but and that's fair enough as far as it goes. But sometimes I feel there's a bit too much of that in Call of Cthulhu. There's a bit too much of it. Because it's not the only scene where there is things like that. There's other things that happen where you think, I can't really do much about it. And that I do find that as a player a little bit frustrating. What I want to do is, you know, save the person who's been sacrificed, you know.
Or intervene
in some way. Because for me, that seems more heroic, or more what a role-playing game is all about. You know, the fun of a role-playing game is not to sit on the sidelines and watch cosmic horror. It's to intervene and go, right, let's sort this, let's do something about it, let's stop it. And I think Cthulhu, I mean, I can see why it's a very, let's not be mistaken, it's a very important role-playing game, because when it emerged, it set in place some different concepts. So it did that, we've talked about this many times before, I think. It made that shift between being a character that goes up the levels, kills things, goes up the levels, gets better, gets more powerful, you know, becomes a rune lord, becomes a 12th level wizard, becomes this, becomes that. It moved more in the direction of your character's kind of doomed. It's more about playing a role, accepting that fact, playing a role in a world where you accept that you're doomed, you're going to go mad, you're going to get shredded by some monster. And all those things are quite important things that fed into role-playing and changed role-playing. So I'm not taking away any of its significance in that sense. But just sometimes, as a player, I do find it is a taste thing, isn't it? I find it frustrating because my gut instinct is to go, right, okay, this person, over there, there's a scene in Fungi from Yuggoth, isn't there, where the cultists drag some woman out of a car and they're going to sacrifice her, and they summon some monster out of the sea. And my instinct all the time as a player is intervene, save the woman. They're going to murder an innocent person.
And I think all the time I was saying, no.
But all the time, but you're right, you were saying, no, we can't do this. And Eddie was hinting very heavily to me, don't do it, you can't do it.
Yeah.
And you're both right, but that is what I find slightly frustrating about Cthulhu at times. That sense of, I can't do anything about it, I'm just an observer.
Yeah.
Sometimes it descends into RPG in a capacity of an observer.
Yeah.
Whereas for me, good RPG is being a participant with agency.
Yeah.
You can do something about it. And that's what sort of frustrates me.
The difficulty I have with that is that if you accept what you're saying, and that, you know, the idea of this is so that you can make a difference and things, and play it in that pulpy style where, you know, the characters have a bit more power. The difficulty with that is that, does it not descend into just being a dungeon crawl with tentacled monsters?
It does, but then I think Cthulhu does anyway at times.
Because that scene where, you know, all the things that you picked out as bits that you like Hoffman's castle and the Egyptian scene. Really, it was just like dungeon crawls, wasn't it?
Yeah, but then I think Cthulhu can be like that. I think it can be like that. I think sometimes it's dressed up as it's not like a dungeon crawl, but it can be, really. Just a dungeon crawl you're going to die in. That's part of the problem. But I don't know, it's a bit like when we played Knights Black Agents. There's a phrase in Knights Black Agents where they say something about, you might be able to correct me on this, but it's something on the lines of, you know, you can win or something. It says you can win.
This is where you can win.
You can win. Yeah. Now, I know role-playing games are not about winning. They are about winning. They're not about winning. But that for me, is a subtle distinction. In Knights Black Agents, you are a secret agent fighting vampires, fighting powerful creatures, more powerful than you, but you can win, you can defeat them. In Cthulhu, there's a definite sense that you can't.
Yeah.
That you won't.
But that to, isn't...
That is a taste thing, perhaps.
It is a taste thing, because isn't that part of the thrill, the kind of cosmic horror, that when you were when we were faced with
that? I don't know. We're not sure it is. I think it's just losing hit points on a character sheet. That's not a thrill.
Yeah.
Write in if you find that a thrill. I've lost... my hit points and all my sanity. What a thrill.
But it's a thrill of... it's the horror...
It can be, yeah.
It's the horror of realising the insignificance in the middle of all this.
Maybe if I played it with a good games master, it might be different.
I that's terrible to say.
But I can see that. I can see it.
But what I can see to you is that I do think, having played back to back Master Nerfletet, which I games mastered, and Fungi from Yuggoth, Eddie games mastered, I think we're probably suffering from a bit of campaign fatigue.
Yeah.
Because I do accept that. You know, one of my characters that I had in there, quite a long-term character, was Olive Kingsburg. Mm. Part of the thing of role-playing, isn't it? Developing a character.
Yes.
And she was a good character because even when we went through various horrific things, for one reason or another, she never saw any of it.
No, she didn't.
She was the daughter of a soap magnate. So she had lots of money, so she would bankroll in all these trips that people, because she wanted to see the occult, she wanted to see what was going on. She was studying it, she had a fascination with the horrors and believed that there was something beyond.
Yeah.
And she heard of this brotherhood and she was fascinated by it in a kind of literary way. She wanted to turn it into some kind of parlour story that she could tell to her friends. And she never saw any of it.
No.
She never saw any of it. Until we went to Egypt and she was eaten by a monster. And something was lost.
She did.
Something was lost in that moment. Because I had an investment in that character.
Yes. And I think that's true. That can be a problem with it. In that when a character dies in a role-playing game, there's nothing wrong with a character dying in a heroic way. Or almost like a knowing way that, you know, this is a crunch moment, this is it, you know, you might go down here, but that's okay, it's worth it. You're defending the village, you're doing this, you're doing that. But in Cthulhu, you can die quite randomly,
as
your character did, where suddenly, out of the blue, wallop, you're dead. Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, head bitten off,
Head bitten off. Which, if it was a horror movie, it would be good. But it's not a horror movie, is it? It's a role-playing game. And your investment in that character, you feel a little bit, that's a bit awkward, isn't it?
Yeah.
Bumped off out of the blue.
Only because we have to continue the story. So if that happened within a one-shot, or whether it was, you know, a character that I haven't spent a lot of time with, you could say there was some glory in the death.
Yeah.
But it's because of the campaign and this need
for the campaign,
continuity.
And I think that's true, actually. You're right there, that Cthulhu one-shot and Cthulhu campaign are actually quite different things. But perhaps more different than one-shot stroke campaigns in other games, which are probably very similar experiences, but Cthulhu can be very different. And in some ways, it lends itself to a one-shot, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The idea, if you're playing a one-shot, you think, might die, might get killed. Fair enough. And it lends itself to that Cthulhu, whereas campaigns are trickier, aren't they, to maintain.
I think what we've done is, because we had a nostalgia for those globe-trotting campaigns back in the day, where, you know, you're going to different places around the world, combating this evil that was unearthing, these strange events that were happening. We wanted to replicate that. And really, it's just given us one flavour of Call of Cthulhu, when there are lots of different flavours, isn't there?
Different ways of approaching it. That's true. Yeah. You can approach it in different ways.
And I think that's where I can see perhaps campaign fatigue is wrong, but I did feel that playing this with you, that much of the time you were kind of exasperated.
Yeah, I think you're right to some extent. I mean, I did enjoy it. I didn't not enjoy it. It's a role-playing game. I like role-playing games, so I enjoyed it. But I do think it's it can be a bit exasperating from that perspective, that you do feel like you're paralysed, you can't do anything. Your sense of agency is taken away. And in a role-playing game, agency is what it's all about, because that's the whole essence of it in some senses. The relationship between game master and players is agency, isn't it? So even at its most basic level, games master says you come to a door, you decide whether you want to open it.
Yeah.
If games master says you come to a door but you can't open it, that's what Cthulhu feels like sometimes. Yeah. Come to a door, but you're not allowed to open it, and that can be frustrating.
So halfway through this campaign, so when we left Peru and went to San Francisco, Eddie retrofitted it with 7th edition rules, and next time we're going to look a bit more detail of 7th edition rules. But I do think that it injected more of what you like.
Yes, it does. It does. Because I know we're going to talk about this later, but things like burning your luck and re-rolling stuff gives you a sense of, I have a little bit more power, might be the wrong word, but I have a little bit more
of a chance, more of an ability.
You, exactly, you've got a bit of a chance. You've got luck rolls, you've got things that, I know you've got luck rolls in original Cthulhu, but it plays slightly differently in 7th edition, doesn't it?
Yeah,
you know, the idea of burning luck, the idea of re-rolling, but if you don't do it, there's more of a consequence.
I think the finale that we talked about in the fight within the Zeppelin was partly down to the fact that we felt more liberated by the fact that we had
a
bit more power do it.
I think that's true. I think 7th edition does give you that as a player. It gives you a sense of, perhaps not that you can win, but you can do more.
Yeah,
got more, because it a bit more elbow room.
We should add that it wasn't the pulp rules, but
no.
It did feel more pulpy even without the additional pulp powers.
Yeah, definitely.
So that's Fungi from Yuggoth, another great campaign that we've returned to. What would you like to do next with Call of Cthulhu? If I said to you, right, Blythe, we're going to have a game of Call of Cthulhu.
Well, you asked that question, but you know what I'd like to do. You know, I'm very interested in Pulp Cthulhu.
Pulp Cthulhu.
Pulp Cthulhu. Because I do think, you see, this is the thing, going back to the library in space, that transition is difficult with Cthulhu as it stands now, because it all jars slightly. But I think Pulp Cthulhu, it would feel a bit different, wouldn't it? It would feel more, I don't know, I might be wrong, time will tell, won't it? But it feels as though that kind of idea might be more palatable in a pulpy setting.
Yeah.
Somehow it would work better. I don't know.
Yeah.
I might be wrong.
Punching a mago in the face, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. Well, there you go, mago. Isn't it? That's exactly it, isn't it? Going to that mago colony in the original Cthulhu, you felt slightly passive, but Pulp Cthulhu, there's a sense where maybe I will get to blow it up with dynamite. Essentially, if I get to blow it up with dynamite, that's a good session of role playing, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, it's getting late for scribbling and scratching on the paper.
Yes.
And something's going to give under this pressure, and the cracks are already beginning to show. We've got to go and see Marillion. Marillion.
And I need some more space mead. Get me another pint of space mead.
All right, hang on, let's put this. Cheers, Blythe.
Cheers.
See you later.
See you later.
There isn't another bit. Having complained about campaign fatigue and wanted to explore different flavours of the game rather than globe-trotting pulpy adventures, in January 2018, I'll be starting an online campaign of The Two-Headed Serpent. That's how addictions work, isn't it? This recently released adventure, written by Scott Dorwood, Paul Fricker and Matt Sanderson, who many of you will know as the host of the consistently excellent Good Friends of Jackson Elias podcast about Call of Cthulhu, horror films and horror gaming in general. It's a cracking campaign using the 7th edition Pulp Cthulhu rules. I'm currently recruiting Games Master so we can run a few sessions concurrently. More information will be available to patrons soon.
Speaking of Patreon, we've had many new members of the Grog Squad who joined us in September. The Patreon campaign can be found in the links to the show notes. The podcast will always be free to listen to, but the tips we gratefully receive encourage us to do other activities such as the Grogzine, which will be available by PDF in December 2017, and Grogmeet, which will be taking place next month in Manchester. So, this is a Patreon thanks at $1. Julio Pasta, Dylan Horrocks, who's also upped his pledge as well. He's a comic artist from New Zealand. He's got some great work if you seek it out. Juho Rutila. Sandai Hudi, who's a local person who we met last year, and he's always been a champion of the Grognard Files, so it's great to have him on board. Simon Lyle, Evan Edwards, Dylan Ross, and Ray Otis. Welcome to you all. Welcome to the Grog Squad. Pull up a poof and stay a while. You're very welcome. At $3.50 level, we have Peter Hoskin, Filthy Monkey, Mikhail Sedlakio, Andrew Seaton, who's increased his bid, Andrew Stimpson, and Michael Watson. Thank you very much. You virtually have an armchair, a poof, and a hobnob. Great to have you on board. Thank you very much. When it comes to the $5 backers, I like to award people who back at this level a gift from a table relevant to the subject under discussion. Call of Cthulhu is mercifully free of table, so I've decided to create my own, the Marillion Randomizer, to dedicate a song to these premium backers. First up, I've got Andy Acton. Okay, let's roll that. It's 63. Forgotten Sons, Armalite, Streetlights, Night Sights, Searching the Roofs for a Sniper, a Viper, a Fighter. Next up is David Matheson, and he's got 65. Script for a Jester's Tear. Losing on the Swings, Losing on the Roundabouts. Next up is Ralph Playman. Thanks for the iTunes reviewers too. And he's got 85. Jigsaw. Dream coins for the fountain, or to cover your eyes. Okay, and next up is Newt Newport, the OSR magician. And he's got 14, and that's The Heart of Lothian, The Rootin' Tootin' Cowboys, Lucky Little Ladies in the Watering Holes. They'll score the Friday night goals. And next up, Nick Lockwood. My goodness, he's got 44. That's Fugazi, Sheathed Within a Walkman, Aborting Pregnant Conversation. Mark Kitchen gets, he's got 47, which is Assassing, Listen as the Syllables of Slaughter Cut with Calm Precision. And finally, last not least, Hobgoblin Orange, who's contributed to previous episodes, he gets 24. White Russian. You can shut your eyes, you can hide it away. It's gonna come back another day. There you go. Make up a mixtape. Thanks for your support. Next time, the second part has more from Mike Mason as he faces the Games Master screen. At Daily Dwarf returns to provide some analysis of the scenarios that appeared in White Dwarf back in the day. Judge Blythe, our resident rules lawyer, will be looking at the 7th edition in more detail. I didn't sound too bitter about Olive Kinnisberg getting her head bitten off by a monster, did I? I only mentioned it twice. Until then, adios, amigos.